What do you think you're doing? You're listening to Crime Quest, a podcast covering the cold, the solved, and the theories. Join us. Recently, I started watching that show on A&E, The Killing Season, and they did a segment, for those that don't know, The Killing Season is about the Long Island serial killer who they believe is responsible for some other murders that happened in Daytona Beach, Florida. And they're usually, I think all of them were prostitutes, or they were like known drug users, or, and I think that they all frequented a website called The Backpage, which is like a solicitation escort website. Yeah, it's like an escort website, kind of like a offshoot of Craigslist, I guess. And
dark Craigslist.
Like definitely a dark side of Craigslist. Which, if anybody ever wants like something hilarious to read, just go to the missed connections section on Craigslist. Like it is the best if you ever need a laugh. Anyway, so I was watching the show and they, you know, started talking about how a lot of the law enforcement agencies in the U.S. don't use a unified database to identify possible serial killers. There is a database that was established by the FBI back in 1985 called VICAP. And the problem is that nobody uses that database. So we've got like 17,000 databases for each law enforcement agency. And right. Some of them do use VICAP. So I don't want to make it sound like nobody's using it, because people are definitely using it. It's just that it's not being utilized to the extent that it's doing much good. And so what this show talks about is how, first of all, there's a huge lack of data, and it causes something called linkage blindness. And I looked up the definition for this, and I'll post in the show notes the link where you can find this. But linkage blindness is, according to the website, practicalhomicide.com, is an investigative failure to recognize a pattern which links one crime with another in crime in a series of cases through victimology, geographic region, or area of events, the signature of the offender, similar MO, and a review of autopsy protocols. So if you have somebody, you know, we encountered this with the Timothy Spencer case that we reviewed. The murders happened in Richmond, and it took, you know, the gall of a detective in Arlington to reach out and say, oh, actually there were some stranglings or something that happened in Richmond. Let me reach out to them. But, you know, that's only, what, an hour or two away? So if somebody commits a murder in Virginia and, or they kidnap, let's say they kidnap somebody or they abduct somebody and they drive them three states away, kill them, and dump their body, those two law enforcement agencies are not likely to talk to each other about that. And so a lot of things get missed. Now, I don't want to make it sound like law enforcement is doing nothing and they're not doing anything at all to connect the dots. I think they are, but I think there are huge gaps in the data. It goes without saying. And what the show on A&E talks about is there's a guy named Thomas Hargrove, and he's an investigative journalist and a guy that developed something called the Murder Accountability Project, and that's the acronym is conveniently MAP, so MAP. And it can be found at murderdata.org. And Hargrove, again, he's an investigative journalist. He began collecting homicide data from all 50 states, resulting in the most comprehensive database of such crimes. According to Hargrove, in the 1960s, and listen to this, this is what I found to be fascinating. In the 1960s, the murder solve rate was 90%. Now it's less than two-thirds.
Oh, Oh my gosh.
Yeah, and so when I heard that, I was like, okay, so that could be one of several reasons. So one of them could be that, well, murders were probably not solved, or were solved more frequently back then, because maybe the laws weren't as stringent on things like any kind of conflicting evidence. What am I trying to say? So, like, if somebody were accused of something, maybe the burden of proof was a little different in the 1960s, whereas now,
right.
You know, we've learned our lesson. We don't want to convict innocent people. And perhaps because of that, and because of DNA coming out, people are a lot less likely to just run with a case and get it all the way through trial, whereas back then things were a little more fluid. And now there's a lot more roadblocks that law enforcement and prosecutors and defense attorneys are up against. So maybe that could be why the solve rate has gone down. But I thought that was pretty astonishing.
That just seems like with the technology we've got today and all of these extra resources, you'd think it would go the other way.
Yeah, that's what I thought. Like, why would we have... We have the internet. Like, why would there... It should go up. Like, we shouldn't have... I mean, 90% solve rate, that is insane.
That's huge.
I have not verified this. It was on the television show, The Killing Season, and if anybody wants to check it out, it's on episode 6 is where they talk about this. Again, I have not verified that data that he says. I think it would be interesting if any of our listeners want to dig into that to see if that's even true, or find out what reasons would allow for a 90% solve rate. But at any rate, I think that it's important to note that there are still a ton of unsolved cases out there, and that's part of the reason why we're doing this show. But I also know that back in the 1960s, people weren't using any databases like we have now to identify patterns or anything like that. So, and maybe they were just, they didn't have the internet, or, you know, it was antiquated information back then. So was police work better back then? I mean, I don't know, but it just seems like such a big gap. So,
yeah.
Anyway, it really got me thinking about how we can help. So what are things that we can do as citizens to help solve these cases? And of course, calling and submitting tips are really important, but if you don't live in the area where you are really involved in the case at all, I mean, what tips could you provide? So what I found is that if there's a couple of websites that you can go to that allow you to compare and contrast unidentified deceased persons with missing persons. And at first I was like surprised that there were so many unidentified bodies, especially when you consider DNA. But I also remember that DNA research for each person is not only expensive, but there's a huge backlog on DNA labs for things like this. So, for example, it can take well over 3 months to even get a DNA result. So I wanted to talk about what I've been doing as kind of a hobby recently, is I've been reviewing these sites and reviewing the unidentified bodies that have been found with the missing person's photographs. And I'm going to go through it step by step. And I'm going to post this as well on our blog, on our website. But I will say that it's pretty easy to do once you get the hang of it. All you need is an internet connection. And just want to illustrate, you know, that law enforcement is strained for resources. So the people are not doing this. Like it's up to us as the citizens and as web sleuthers to go in and help to identify these. So let me just start. I'm going to start with step one.
Okay.
All right. So the first thing you do is you need to go, you need to find an unidentified person on the DOE network and what you do is you click on, and I'm going to provide the DOE network's website also, but the DOE network I think it's doenetwork.org, but you go there, you look for an unidentified person found on Doe Network by clicking on case files and unidentified, either geographical or chronological. So you either want to say, I want to find them by where they were located or what year they were located or like a timeline. And I usually pick geographical. Click on, once you get there, you're going to click on U.S. if that in fact is where you want to look. There also is a section, I think, for Canada and maybe even Mexico. So click on that and you enter a state in the box under the sentence U.S. United States Unidentified Males Geographical Index. So it defaults to males, and if you want to view the females, you click on View Females, and then you can search by your state of and by gender. So just go through the photos. I'm going to give a disclaimer here. A lot of the photos, they're not going to be of the actual body. They are going to be forensic composite drawings, or they're going to be like recreations, like facial reconstructions.
Okay.
So,
that's probably.
Yeah, and so, yeah. So you go down the list, you identify someone that you want to begin researching by clicking on them. You read their profile completely, and some of the profiles may have the NamUs case number listed at the bottom. Now, NamUs is the database that you can use to search for what are called rule outs. So the NamUs database not only contains the unidentified people, but it also contains a list of all of the missing people that you want to use to compare to the Doe Network site. So you can search. So once you search on NamUs for the rule out, so, okay, let me finish. So to do this, you either click on the case number or copy and paste into NamUs Unidentified Persons Database. Search under NamUs UP number under case information. The profile will appear and you'll notice a table labeled exclusions. So these folks have been ruled out as being a match for the Doe Network individual. So I'm going to talk more about that in a minute. But essentially, in step two, you're identifying someone you want to search on. You are reading their profile, seeing, you know, they're going to give you an estimated time of death, an age estimation, a height and weight. They're going to have the drawing and the facial reconstruction so you can see what they kind of what they think they looked like. And they'll have a little synopsis of what they found on the body, maybe what they were wearing. They'll have photographs of what was found with the body. And all of that is what you can take to the NamUs database and figure out if any of that information matches with a missing person. So, for example, if somebody went missing and they were wearing a blue t-shirt and blue jeans and black shoes, and they were a Hispanic male that was 5'10" and 180 pounds, and he went missing in Virginia in June of 2010, and then a body was found in August of 2010 in West Virginia meeting that exact description, and you've also found that that person has not been ruled out of the Doe Network person, then that is where you want to make some notes about it, say why you think it could be a match, and you're going to do what's called requesting a match. So I'm probably going to have to review that again, but that was step two in a nutshell. So step three is where you search on NamUs site for anyone matching Doe Network by going to identifyus.org and clicking on Missing Persons Database. So that's what I was saying earlier is, you know, that's where you want to look for anyone that you can match up with the Doe Network person. Now, you don't want to just, like, dive into that website. You do want to have some parameters. So step three, you're going to search on sex and state. So if the person on the Doe Network is a male whose body was found in Virginia, you would search for male under sex and Virginia under state. And then once you've ruled out a state, you move on up to surrounding states and so forth. And why do we do this? Well, it's because many killers do not dispose of the bodies close to home. So, yeah, so, like, if somebody was, again, like, murdered, found, you know, their body was found in Atlanta, Georgia, they could have actually been reported missing from Louisiana. So that's where you want us, you know, you want to start with the state where the decedent was found, but you want to move out into the surrounding states and even further sometimes. As you, you know, if you watch the Killing Season series, you'll notice that they talk a lot about, they really focus on the fact that a lot of long-haul truckers or a lot of serial killers might be long-haul truckers, and they have the ability to cross state lines constantly and to conceal a body. So that's something to consider in when you're thinking about where you want to search, is that, you know, somebody does have the ability to stick a body in their car and move it to another area.
Okay.
It happens all the time. And so not only that, you know, localities, as I said before, are not sharing their databases like they should be. So if someone, again, went missing in New York and they don't have a connection to Virginia in a database without actually coming onto these sites, you know, you wouldn't know.
Okay.
Does that make sense? Stop me if I'm, like,
yes,
going nuts and too fast here.
No, that makes total sense.
Okay, cool. And so then in the step four, I have it as looking at the estimated date of death on Doe Network, and this will give you an idea of where to begin on your search results for NamUs. So you've identified a state, and you want to, you're going to, and a sex or a gender. So you're pulling up, you know, all the males that went missing in Virginia, let's say. And
right,
you're going to look for a date range, and you're going to compare that with the estimated date of death on the Doe Network site. So, for example, if someone's date of death was December 1993, you would start searching around that time on NamUs. Also, you want to look at estimated age and height and weight and identifiers. This is a big thing here that I just realized this morning, is that if there's no dental DNA or fingerprints, law enforcement has no way of confirming the match. So even though you may think there's a match, they look alike, if we have nothing to go on, if we have no fingerprints or any real way to confirm it, law enforcement or the match committee is going to kick it back. And I'll explain more about that in a minute. So then you move on to step five. When you find someone on NamUs meeting the criteria of the person on the Doe Network, you click on the record and you read the entire thing looking for ways to rule them out. So search for their name in the list of exclusions under the unidentified profile on NamUs. I usually open another tab for this. So, like, I have a tab open for NamUs under the... So let me just back up for a minute. It's probably a ton of information for people, but... So the person that's listed on the Doe Network, the deceased person, they also are going to have a record on NamUs. And what you can do is you can pull up their record on NamUs in a separate tab, and within their profile, they're going to have a little box that says exclusions. So as you're searching the NamUs missing persons in one tab, you're going to have another tab open for NamUs unidentified person that you're looking at from the Doe Network, so that you can exclude anyone you find on the NamUs missing persons from the NamUs unidentified person, and you can compare them. So
okay.
I was today I was working on a girl or a lady whose body was found in Fairfax, Virginia back in 1993, and I submitted 4 match requests this morning, and 2 of them got kicked back because there were no identifiers, even though when I looked at the table of names under her record that said that they've excluded these people, the people that I identified as missing that may match this woman were not on there. So I was like, okay, well, that means they haven't reviewed it. Let me submit a match. But then it got kicked back because she didn't have any, the people I submitted, they didn't have fingerprints, DNA, or dental records. So it was like, we couldn't really do much about those.
Okay.
Which is unfortunate, but
yeah.
That aside, all right, now let me get myself together here. All right, so again, step six is when you've determined you might have a match because, one, the person hasn't been excluded from the unidentified record, and two, the circumstances and demographics match. Go to the DOE Network and click on the tab Potential Matches and submit a match. So you're using, so the DOE Network site is actually where you're going to submit the match, not on NamUs. And then you can fill out the form completely, and a committee of volunteers reviews the potential matches before moving forward with submitting to law enforcement. You will receive an email letting you know if your match is going to move forward or be rejected. So this morning, again, I submitted four, and the lady that runs it, she emails you back pretty quickly, and she'll say, you know, no, we have to exclude this. Or the first one I ever submitted, they still haven't gotten back to me as to whether that may be a potential match.
Okay.
So I was actually really excited about that because that could mean that, you know, maybe I've found somebody that could match an unidentified person that was found, and they were actually, the guy went missing from Hanover County back in 2010, and then 2 months later a body was discovered in southern part of Virginia, northern part of North Carolina.
Oh, wow.
And the composite, well, the forensic facial reconstruction looked very similar to this guy's photograph, so, and the height and the weight and the age matched. And the time frame was, you know, they found him like 2 months later. So I still haven't heard back whether they've confirmed or disqualified that. So I'm still waiting to hear on that. But yeah, that's basically it.
That's a great lead.
Yeah. So if you have time, I definitely recommend, you know, people as we head into the holiday season and, you know, our true crimers out there and web sleuths, if, you know, to check this out. It is a great way to help out and to do something, you know, just from the comfort of your own home and to do some research. And you can also find out a lot about these cases on the Web Sleuths website. So I think one of the best ways to search for, so like let's say you're doing research on a Jane, a particular Jane Doe, you can search for that record on websleuths.com, and I think you have to use like the case number or something like that, and usually there's a discussion thread. People will talk about what they've found on it or if it was rejected or, you know, things like that. But it's been really interesting, so I've really actually enjoyed knowing that I can actually make some strides towards helping somebody solve a case or find a missing person.
That's fantastic to be able to do something as a layperson.
Yeah, absolutely. So with that said, do you have questions, Amanda? I know that was a lot. It's a ton, like just explaining it. But yeah.
I'm actually really excited to go look into it myself and just see if there's anything that I could just, sounds like you're making some headway on some.
Yeah, and I have only searched two people. Like, I focused on two unidentifieds, and it's,
mm-hmm.
you know, it's enough just doing two people, and it kind of has given me this idea of just how challenging it is for professional investigators to find information on people.
Right.
I mean, it took me, like, almost a whole morning just to rule out, like, four possible matches, and you know, I mean, that's only four people, so you think about that. Yeah, it's really interesting.
That's great. And there's, I mean, if you think about the people all over the country that aren't in our area who can go into the site and using it.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely.
It's not just searching for someone in the Central Virginia area, which is fantastic.
Yeah, that's the thing, is like, that's part of what's interesting about it, is that unless you went missing from and were also found in the same jurisdiction where you went missing, a lot of these things go unsolved. So if you're abducted and then you're found three states away, you know, especially, and I think that, you know, law enforcement does have, what is it, the Be On The Lookout reports that they send to, like, everyone, and they have all that, and it's not, I'm not saying that they're not doing anything. I don't want anyone to think that, but what I am saying is that when you talk about 10 or 15 years going by, you know, nobody is really, like, things happen, you know, things are always happening in our world, so nobody is looking for these people after a certain amount of time, and that's just the reality of it, so...
Yeah. And, I mean, not all of them are crime victims either, right?
Yeah.
And some people who may have just wandered away because of dementia or some sort of mental illness, something like that.
Yeah.
So those families definitely need some closure, too.
Absolutely.
I'm sure that's terrifying.
Well, that's what's so heartbreaking is I have an especially strong affinity for looking for missing persons, just because I know that it's so painful for families that don't know what's happened to their loved ones. And it's one thing, I'm not trying to minimize the fact that someone, it's, you know, just as bad when you do find out what actually happened to them, but I think it's almost worse when people don't even know where they are or what's become of their life. Yeah.
Unknown, not having that closure.
Absolutely.
The
so,
more
yeah.
Better.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, that's really cool. I'm excited to get on and try that.
Yeah, you definitely should. I think you're really gonna enjoy it. And
yeah.
So you have something.
Yeah, and actually, before we move on, I just want to throw in another endorsement for The Killing Season.
Yeah.
Because I've been watching that too, and it's just riveting. And it's by the same people who did Cropsey, I believe. And, what was the other one that they did? Urban Legend? It was some Urban Legend.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Was the second one, which was good, but not as, I didn't like it as much as Cropsey, but Cropsey was just amazingly well done.
Yeah.
And I don't think they were even professional documentarians at that point. I think it was more of a side project for them. So they've really got a great great sense of what they're doing.
Oh, yeah. They
really fantastic. So yeah, I just wanted to throw that in. And then another plug for Web Sleuths, because they're, that's a great site, too. And I get sucked into it all the time. It's so easy to just start reading a thread and keep going.
Oh, yeah.
2 hours or so.
Yeah, well, I got sucked down a rabbit hole with that, with the first match that I submitted, because the guy's body was found in a lake. Or it was not in the lake, it was, like, next to the lake, and it was skeletal remains. So, I also found where another body a year before that was actually found in the lake, floating in the lake.
Right.
So I got lost on a thread on Web Sleuths of people trying to solve the case of the guy whose body was floating in the lake. He had a very distinguishing tattoo on his on his bicep, or like his upper, like his shoulder. And so Web Sleuths like blew up, and I read, like, spent a lot of time reading that. It was, it was really interesting. But those people, there were people like even calling, like making phone calls to local tattoo shops and asking if that was a tattoo they did. Like, these people are serious.
Yeah.
Really, like, they were actually investigating. Yeah.
Okay.
It's amazing.
Yeah, it's just, I think there's actually been, I mean, maybe not completely solved, but there have been some really good leads on a bunch of cases from them.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
That have been taken seriously. So, yeah, I can't recommend that enough. That was a great site.
Yeah.
Should we move on a little bit?
Yeah, let's talk about your crazy Brooklyn jury duty case.
All right. So, I'm going to talk today. I'm not actually going to do a historical murder. It's kind of historical if you think about the fact that it was 16 years ago. I think it was 16. Actually, it was 15 years ago. So we're going to talk about an experience I had being on the backside of a crime, I guess, is what you'd call it. I lived in Brooklyn, and this is the only time I have ever been called for jury duty. Like, in my entire life, no matter where else I've lived, I've never gotten until I moved to Brooklyn.
Yeah, I've never been called on jury duty.
Yeah, it's so amazingly random, and everybody, when I lived in Ohio, everybody in my family was getting called to jury duty, and I didn't get called. So
you weren't good enough, Amanda.
I know. No, I'm like, wait a minute, I've done this before. Why am I not getting called?
Oh,
but
man.
Once I tell you about this, I think it's kind of a blessing in disguise for me not to get called now. So in 2000 and I believe it was 2002. It was 2002. It was a year after 9/11. I was living in Brooklyn trying to be a writer, and I got this jury duty summons, which actually kind of came at an awkward time because I had just been laid off from my job, and I had all the free time in the world. So I went to the jury duty summons, and when I went in, it turns out that they were selecting jurors for a murder trial. And I guess I answered everything correctly, if you can say that, because I got selected for this jury for the murder trial.
Wow.
Yeah. And I'm going to preface this with saying this was probably one of the most emotional things I've ever done. So if you think, you can think it's awesome and cool to think about being on a murder trial, but if you ever get called for one, it really is emotional for the jurors, too. I really think it is.
Mm.
So it ended up being about a 3-week trial, so it was a good thing I was laid off. I got called for the trial. What had happened, it was gang-related. And it happened in East New York, which is not a fantastic, it's one of the more dangerous parts of Brooklyn. And the trial that I was serving on the jury for was for two brothers who were being tried for second-degree murder, I believe was the charge. And there was actually another guy involved who was being tried, but he was tried in a separate trial. And I guess because these two were brothers, we were hearing both of their cases at the same time. So we had to decide on verdicts for both of them separately, but the trial was all together. So we get in, we started the first day, went through all the rules, all the stuff from the judge as to what we need to hear. We were not sequestered, so I was able to go home every night. It was not high profile enough. So I went home, walked back home to my apartment in Brooklyn. And in Brooklyn, if you've ever been there or been to New York, the courthouse is actually in Brooklyn Heights, which is right across the river from Manhattan. And I lived in Park Slope, so I was a little bit further out, but I was still within walking distance to the courthouse. So that was kind of cool. So the first day, they gave us all of the instructions. I think the jury was a good mix of people. It was pretty diverse. I think I was probably the youngest one on it. And then then there were some working class. It was a good mix of African American and white, and a couple of Hispanics on it as well. So I think they were going for that diversity. I don't know how they necessarily decide who they want to be on the jury, but in a case like this, I think they would want that sort of diversity to see from different angles. And I will say the brothers were African American. And so going back to the East New York, this was a murder that happened. It was apparently a gang shooting. And the first guy that was being tried in a separate trial, I don't know if he was first being tried for first degree or second degree. I believe everybody was being tried for second degree, but we were not allowed to know anything about that particular trial. For good reason, obviously. We didn't want to be influenced by that trial. So, we have these two brothers. They were 17 and 16, I think, which made it even harder. Yeah. And
well, they were being tried as adults?
They were.
Oh, my gosh. Why is that? Why were they being tried as adults?
I'm not sure. I guess because they were at the age of consent. I mean, they were old enough to understand.
Okay.
What they'd done. I don't know what necessarily the criteria is for trying someone as an adult, but maybe it was just the heinousness of the crime.
Mm-hmm.
And their particular. I don't know if they had past. Any past records. I don't believe that they had any past issues with crime. So, if this was their first offense, that just is even worse. So the shooting, there was a person killed, and it seems like it was, if I remember correctly, it was an innocent bystander that was killed.
Okay.
Yeah,
was it like they were meaning to like kill somebody else and they didn't, like they accidentally killed someone, or was it?
I think so because it actually I do remember that the shooting happened right by a McDonald's.
Okay.
So I think it was either mistaken identity or it was just that was not the person that they meant to kill.
Okay.
So, the information on the trial, we were actually in the trial for a good 3 weeks at that point. It was a lot of, the prosecution brought on a lot of witnesses. We had both character witnesses, who both testified that, you know, the boys had never been in trouble for anything like this before. They were good kids. The prosecution, it was the opposite, but, you know, these were known gang-related kids, whereas the defense brought on theirs that they were good kids, you know, they hadn't been in trouble before except for a couple of minor things, and so we had a few eyewitnesses, and one of the things that just kept popping up during these eyewitnesses, the older brother, the 17-year-old, it was pretty obvious that he was involved.
Okay. Why is that?
So, because the eyewitnesses basically placed him at the scene of the crime pulling the trigger. And I'm trying to remember, I mean, it was a long time ago, but it's still, like, it's right in my head. You know, you have those experiences where you just don't forget things.
Oh, yeah.
And I took notes the entire time because, you know, I'm a nerd like that. Plus, it was important, and I didn't want to forget anything. So I don't know where that notebook is now. It's probably either gone or packed in boxes from my three or four moves since then. But I remember taking notes, and I remember writing down that there was really no question that the first brother was involved. The biggest question was whether or not the second brother was involved, or he just happened to be in the wrong place with his brother at the wrong time.
Okay.
So we kept going through the trial, and, you know, I'd get home and think about it all day. As much as you try to turn it off, it's really hard. You don't want to think about it when you're done for the day.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, it's on your mind all the time.
Yeah.
And my roommate, I mean, I wasn't supposed to talk about it with anybody, obviously. But my roommate and I did talk about it a little bit. I didn't give him details or anything. Mm-hmm. I just kind of blew off a little bit of steam to him. Because, you know, we were both writers, and he was working in soap opera, so a good melodramatic thing is always fun.
Yeah.
So I blew off steam, and then go back the next day, and just after 3 weeks, the emotions were just, I was ready to crack. I was ready to get into that room and get the verdicts discussed and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So once all of the testimony had been given, we heard a lot from the prosecution, a lot from the defense, and I guess I was really surprised at how long it took and how much work had gone into this trial.
Like, how long what took? Like, the whole trial, or?
Yeah, I mean, it was in September. It started, like, early September, and we were not done until the end of September.
So, I'm always curious, too, like, when they were presenting evidence, was it, you guys are not allowed to write anything down, so how are you retaining what they're telling you?
I would get out and write down my notes, like, on a break as soon as possible.
Oh, okay. So you couldn't write anything, like, while you were in the courtroom, but you were allowed to after?
I don't remember if we were allowed to or not. I remember having a notebook.
Okay.
With my notes, but I don't remember. I mean, I think we were allowed to write down notes while we were hearing testimony.
Okay.
Because I had a whole notebook full of stuff, and I don't think I was able to write all of that on break.
Okay.
So, I don't know, maybe that varies from court to court.
Yeah.
But I know other people had notes as well, so we were able to compare and make sure we were all learning the same thing once we got into the jury. Once we got into the jury room, we compared our notes.
Wow.
So... Once we got in there and we were ready to start deciding the verdict, we elected a foreman. I can't remember who. It was an older gentleman, I believe. Very nice guy. Everybody on the jury was very nice. We were all fairly friendly to each other. I mean, we were all going through this at the same time. And even though there were some disagreements, which I'll get into in a minute, we weren't being rude to each other just to be rude. It was a good group of people, and we all knew why we were there, and we wanted to do the best job, and I think the tension just started to get to some people by the end of it. You know, people were missing work.
Yeah.
Or paying babysitters to watch their kids while they were here, and you get paid for it, I think. I got laid off, I believe, I got laid off right at the start of the trial, so I went to the trial for 2 days and went in on a Friday when we weren't going into the courtroom and got laid off that day.
Wow.
So, it was not a great situation. It was a great job, and I still talk to my boss, actually, from that job, but it was just money-wise, you know, everything we were starting to go into a recession, especially in New York after that time. So, you know, people wanted to just get it over with and go home. And I understood that. And I think some of us really just, we wanted to make sure that we were doing these kids justice.
Yeah.
It was funny, one of my favorite shows used to be L.A. Law. I watched that when I was a teenager all the time. And all I could think was, this trial is nothing like L.A. Law. I mean, it was, the closing closing arguments and things, they're so well done, but they're so long. It's not these impassioned speeches like you see on Boston Legal or LA Law or whatever lawyer show you're watching. They reiterated the evidence. They summarized everything. But, I mean, I believe both of them went over an hour with their closing statement.
Wow.
Yeah. So, I mean, it was not a quick process for those at all. And I think I remember seeing that the On Making a Murderer, that Netflix show, that the trials they were in, I think they said that those were a couple of hours long as well, those closing statements. So,
It's like a filibuster.
Yeah, exactly.
It's like a super long. Yeah, like.
I didn't give any good recipes.
Yeah. And rightfully so. It should be long, and they should be able to say everything they need to say, because that's really the last thing the jury is going to hear before they deliberate, you know?
Exactly. So, we got in there, and we. During the trial, we had been able to leave for lunch. So we were able to go out and get our lunches. When we were deliberating, they ordered lunch in for us for those couple of days that we were there. So we did deliberate for about 2.5 days.
Wow.
And yeah, when we started, we actually came to a verdict for the 17-year-old pretty quickly. We all went through the evidence that had been presented.
So when you're going through the evidence, do you have like a facilitator or someone in the jury that's like the person
there was
that
a jury foreman.
Okay.
Yeah, we had the foreman, and he kept us on track. I was not volunteering for that job at all. So he was willing to do it, which was great. I believe they asked for volunteers, and when no one volunteered, they kind of pointed out to me and this other guy, and he took it, luckily. So he kept us on track, but we did, it was probably a half day of going through the evidence for the first kid and coming to a very strong agreement that was a guilty verdict. And we all felt okay we felt good about that one. Not good as in, great, we're all happy to do this, but we felt good that was the proper conclusion.
You felt confident in your decision,
exactly.
Like that you
confident.
Made the right choice.
Right, that's much better word for it. So then the second one was trickier. When we first took our vote for him, there were, I believe, 7 people that voted guilty for the second kid, and 5 of us that voted not guilty.
Were you one of the 5 that was not guilty?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
What did you base that on? Why did you think he wasn't guilty?
I didn't think that the evidence pointed to him necessarily as being a planned part of it.
Okay.
My thought was that he was in the wrong place at the wrong time, and that was just after the trial and not going through notes at first.
Okay.
So it took us about a day and a half, a little over a day and a half, to get through that. And I will say, people wanted to be done. They were frustrated. And every time we continued to take another vote as to whether or not he was guilty or not guilty, and we continued to have holdout. Tensions did get a little high. People did want to go. They wanted to go home. This was affecting their life.
Yeah.
I mean, we got home at night, but it was having a big impact on our daily lives. And then a few of us just reminded them that, it has an effect on our daily lives, but this is going to have an effect on the rest of his life. And we need to be absolutely sure. So, going into it, I'd say I was about 60% sure that he had done it to 40% unsure.
Wow.
And, yeah.
You're talking about the youngest one, right?
Right, the 16-year-old.
Okay.
The 16-year-old. With the first one, it was 99% positive.
Oh, okay.
That he has done it. So, because he had connections to the first defendant that was in the other trial, he had some connections that were just undeniable that tied him to it without any sort of issue. And then the eyewitnesses solidified that. So then we kept going, and I think we had, in the first day, the three of the not guilty jurors moved their vote to guilty. So it was two of us that were holding out. And again, the other jurors were not happy with us. I remember some slamming of pencils on the table and sighing and just, let's get this over with.
Wow.
Come on. Yeah. And, I mean, we're all human. Everyone's human. And it's going to get tense. I mean, I think we've talked about this, but the OJ trial, that miniseries with Sarah Paulson, when the jury was in the jury room, I felt a very strong understanding of how those jurors were reacting.
Yeah. It's a lot of time in a room with people, and you're tired, and you just want it to be over, and I completely understand that. I mean,
and we kept going over the evidence. After about a day, I had gone from the 60-40 to about 90-10 in favor of the guilty verdict.
Wow. What changed for you?
Honestly, we compared our notes to make sure that everything was correct, that we had the correct timeline. We looked at, I mean, we went through everything with a fine-tooth comb, and it was almost like a checklist. Like, you know, we'd find this, and I could check it off and add it to the guilty side of things.
Yeah.
And it was, we were very, very deliberate, or at least most of us were, obviously. It was their job to show me where they had the guilty verdict in their head, and my job to show them where I didn't see that guilty verdict.
Right.
Along with the other juror, the second juror that was still not guilty. So in that last half day, I'd say it took me a little bit longer. The last juror the other juror did go to a guilty verdict in that last half day. I was still the last holdout, and we were actually told that we could not come back without a verdict, so we were not going to be allowed to come back and say we're a hung jury.
Wow. Why is that? I thought it was, they were, like, it doesn't, they can say that you're not allowed to do that? I didn't know that.
I remember that, and maybe it was just to get us to get a verdict. But we sent a note to the judge that said we're here, and he sent a note back that just said keep deliberating.
Okay.
So I guess maybe we could have gone back to the grand jury if they wanted us to continue. Teenage years, and then for a lot of their adult life. But I mean, logically, I can look back, and I do think I made the right decision. But again, there's just always going to be that one part of you that's like, what did I do? Am I doing this right? Did I do something wrong with this?
Yeah.
It was extremely emotional. And then, so when we finally had all 12 of us at a guilty verdict, we went back into the courtroom, and this picture is never going out of my head. We gave the verdict to the judge. He read the verdict as guilty. I did not want to look at the defendants or the family because I didn't want that image in my head of them being told that their son and their brother and their cousin were going to jail because of what we decided.
Yeah.
So when the judge read the one out, the one thing that I remember really strongly is the prosecutor. She was pretty young. She looked like this had been one of her first cases. She looked like she was about 27 or 28.
Wow.
She burst into tears. She tried to control herself because I guess, you know, she wanted to remain professional. But I think it was, I think she was just so, it was a huge stress off of her to have done so much on this case and to get the verdict that she wanted.
Yeah.
So I really remember that from her, and I remember like having so much empathy for her because I hadn't worked on the case as long as her, but I could understand why it made her that emotional. Once we read the verdict, they told us thank you and, you know, we appreciate it, and you're free to go. And we left the courtroom. I'll admit, I was a little nervous to leave because I was worried, you know, what if they try to retaliate against the jurors?
Yeah, did they like, walk you out to your car or anything?
No, I didn't have a car.
Okay.
I just walked home, and nobody did anything to any of the jurors. Nobody even, like, looked at us and tried to threaten us or anything.
Yeah.
It was accepted. But once I got out, said goodbye to the other jurors, I mean, you've just spent 3 weeks of your life with these people. So I started walking home, and at that point, I lost it.
Yeah.
I started crying. And it was just such, it was a relief, but it was also such a moment where all I could think was, I just sent two kids to jail for 30 years.
Yeah.
How could they do that?
Well,
it wasn't logical, but it was how I just let my emotions out from the last 3 weeks.
Yeah, I bet.
Oh.
Well, yeah, I mean, were people, like, crying when you were deliberating at all?
I did get a little teary. I don't do well when people are upset with me.
Yeah.
So when someone got upset with me and, like, was slamming pencils and hands on the table, I got a little teary, but I did stand my ground, and I was kind of proud of myself for that, because usually I'm not always the best at doing that.
Mm-hmm.
But, no, I mean, we were trying to all keep it logical. So I think I was just emotional at that point. Plus, I just lost my job, so I was already emotional from that. I didn't really show a lot of emotion until I got outside. And then I walked home, and my roommate was there, and I was finally able to tell him about everything. So I went through it, and I literally just cried on him for a good 10 minutes.
Wow.
So, and I mean, I still think about those kids. I still think about, are they out? Are they still in jail? What if I made the wrong decision? What if we all made the wrong decision? And I don't think we did. But there's always that what if. So that's why I never want to get called for jury duty again.
That sounds like a really intense experience.
It really was. And if I ever get called on a murder trial jury again, I'll basically tell them I think I'm the Virgin Mary to get out of it.
Yeah, they people use all kinds of tactics to get out of jury duty.
I know.
Well, I'm really glad you shared that story. It made it put a whole new light to me on being on a jury duty. It seems very intense, but also really like an important part of our legal process. So I'm really glad that you got to participate in that. And even though I know it was emotional, I think that is a necessary thing that has to happen, unfortunately.
Right. Yeah. If it wasn't, it's someone else. I didn't mind doing my civic duty. I can't ever do like a crime trial again.
Yeah.
Too emotionally, and I think I put in my time for that. I don't think I should ever have to.
Well, thanks so much. Yeah.
That's my story.
All right.
So.
Well, I don't have anything else to add. But do you?
No.
Well.
No. Review and subscribe on iTunes. We've started out a little slow, so the more people who rate and review on iTunes, the sooner we'll go up and get into their, you know, news and noteworthy or
yes, absolutely.
So,
yeah, and I wanted
really
to
appreciate that.
Yeah, yes, and I wanted to mention that I did tweet about this today, but Patricia Cornwell, who is an author from Richmond, Virginia, is looking for inspiration for her 25th novel, and I'm asking our listeners to please tweet her at 1pcornwell and recommend that she uses the case of Mike, Margaret, and Donna Hall, the first episode that we did, as inspiration for her next novel. I think it would be amazing exposure for that case and possibly lead to something. So please do that. But that's all I have to add. So thanks, everybody. Thank you for listening to Crime Quest. It is our goal to make this as informative as possible. If you heard something amazing and want to give us a review, please do so on iTunes along with a rating. If you have suggestions for show topics, please send them to crimequestpod@gmail.com. Also, follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at crimequestpod. Thanks. Crime Quest would like to give special thanks to Hemi Haynes for putting together our music for this episode. Thanks, Hemi!